board. Seconds are running. Good. Olivia and Hugh McClyman.
All right. Well, thank you so much for agreeing to participate in the project. It will surely benefit the community now and in the future. The goal of the questionnaire is to produce a very detailed and coherent account of your story, you know, your life story. And in light of that, I encourage you to speak as much as you'd like to, or as little, however you feel most comfortable. We realize that you have already signed this consent form that you've given me for the audio release. However, if you ever change your mind about anything that you have said during the questionnaire, feel perfectly free to contact us and let us know at any time. You will be getting a photocopy of the content, and that has our contact information, which you can always reach. And I'm always here in Panama, so you can always call me anytime. All right, let me start with the first question. This is a background question. let's see. Tell me about your place of birth and what was going on there when you were growing up. We can start with Mrs. O'Connor, and then continue.
Okay, my date of birth is April 20th, 1935. Mm-hmm. I don't really know what was going on there when I was born.
Uh-huh. But what would be your earliest childhood memories that you could recall?
Just living.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing spectacular.
Living where?
How? My parents.
Mm-hmm.
It's like parents, my mother and grandmother.
Mother and grandmother.
Yeah.
Any siblings?
Yes, I have two brothers.
Okay. Younger or older?
Much younger.
Okay. And any favorite childhood games or things like that that you recall that you used to play or used to do?
We play pickups and jump rope.
Mm-hmm.
And rounders. You know rounders?
No, I don't.
You know rounders?
No,
he doesn't know rounders.
What
either.
Was rounders?
Rounders is a game that is almost like baseball.
Okay.
But you stand by, you place a rock,
uh-huh.
And you stand by a rock.
Uh-huh.
And when that one person is out, then you move from rock to rock until you go home.
Wow, is that maybe the precursor to baseball?
Probably was. We call it rounders. Okay. But we hit the ball, we throw the ball in the air and we hit it.
With your arm.
Okay. And little games like hopscotch.
Mm-hmm.
You know hopscotch.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that hopscotch is in America.
Stuff like that, I can remember.
Yeah. And do you remember childhood mostly from things you did at home or school or what are the things?
Both.
Yes, both. Yeah. Okay. All right. So, Mr. McClyman, would like to continue? Childhood memories. So what's going on when you were a child, where you were born?
Did you ask for date of birth? Or
well, I'm going to get that at the end either way, but yes, you can give me your date of birth as well. Yes.
Okay, my date of birth is December 31st, 1942. Well, at the time I was born, it was closer to the New Year, so I had very little time in 1942. my place of birth was Dawkins District, Moco, Clarendon, Jamaica, West Indies. At the time I was born, I think the Second World War was on, and it was coming to the end of the Great Depression in the U.S. And most of the activities at that time were concentrated on the war, because I think they were still dropping booby traps, and our parents would tell us not to pick up stuff like matchboxes, cutlery, and so forth, because
wow.
People get blown away.
Wow.
Yeah.
So even in Jamaica, you would have booby traps of sorts?
Sure, because at that time, the Americans were using a base in Jamaica, Burnham Field, which was 12 miles from our household. Mm-hmm. And we could still see the planes coming over, so on. So wherever the Americans had bases, the Germans would follow. Mm. So that's the reason that they told us to be careful of booby traps.
Wow. How long did that last, this whole situation?
Well, I think everything ended in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
So that was within a 3-year period, 1943 to 1946.
Okay, and did it take a long time to, let's say, clean out all these leftover emissions, so to speak?
Well, we're not sure. I never saw anything,
right.
So we're not sure what was there to be cleaned up, because I was just a child at the time, so I don't think there was much. I think the thing was more of a threat to what could happen.
Okay, exactly. Okay. Thank you. Let's focus a little bit on school. What was school like, early school years or later school years?
Good. I enjoyed my school there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go to college or university and stuff like that. I went to what they call elementary school, and then there is another school above that, they say secondary school. And I did a few years in there, don't remember how many, but that was it for school.
Okay. But in
Barbados, the girls have to do home economics. They have to learn to cook and sew and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the boys have got to learn a trade too. Who can do carpentry or tailoring or, something. You can always send your boys or your girls to something.
Okay.
You must learn something. A trade.
Yeah. And any favorite teachers?
I can remember one teacher that was very, very loving to me. Her name was Miss Daniel. And that was in what you would call primary school, first classes. And she was very, very loving to the children.
Mm-hmm.
She's the one that taught me to write and read and stuff like that.
Daniel. Any favorite friends from school?
Oh my, I had a lot. I don't remember all the names. I don't remember the names, but I had a good day.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I can tell you. I don't remember too many names.
What kind of games did you play in school? Are the ones you mentioned before, or are there other
particular
games?
Those are outside. School, we do what they call flat race. I don't know what you do here.
What is flat race?
Flat race is just running, like what you call meter race.
Okay.
100 meters.
Straight, exactly.
Straight run.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the jumping, the high jump.
Mm.
And we call it obstacle. What do you call it? We call it obstacle. You want to jump over there?
Oh, when you're running and
we call that obstacle race, and you jump over these bars, things like that. And at school we had games there where we compete with other schools, little prizes.
Any particular sport you were most into?
I was flat race, and I was high jump, and I rode the racer bike.
Okay, all right. Like that's strong legs. Mr. McLaren, yes. School member.
School was, at my time, was interesting because we lived up in the country. Prep school, was just a little patch hut. And there was one prep school in our entire area. The teacher was Miss Myers. I never got further than Miss Myers. But she was really good. I think I spent maybe 3-4 months in prep school. Then she told my father, it's time for him to go to elementary.
Mm-hmm.
There's no need in keeping his kid here.
Mm-hmm.
But my older brother had a learning disability. And he just couldn't grasp it. And she complained that he's holding me back because I'm putting so much attention on my brother to get him to advance, and he just wouldn't advance. So she said, just ship both of them out to elementary. So we went from prep to elementary in about six months. Elementary was interesting for me because we were switching from the Royal Crown Reader, which was what the English used in England and the West Indies. We were switching from that to Anansi Stories, which was far inferior. And I just, even at that age, I couldn't understand why. And I'm only 4 years old, 4 or 5 years old. I couldn't understand why they want to switch to something that, to me, was nonsense. But quickly they switched to the Anansi Stories, and we did that for the next 6 years. And this is one of the reasons why English is such a difficult subject for, I'd say, for Jamaicans. Here, we, from Anansi Stories, we get patois mixed in. But from the Royal Crown Reader, it was straight English from the Crown. So that's the reason we have problems today with English in school. But I enjoyed elementary, and we had a setback also in 1951. We had a great, the terrible hurricane blew our school down, and we had to wait a year before the new school was rebuilt. So that's like a year lost.
So during that year, you didn't do anything at all? Were there any other initiatives to maybe have the kids do something, learn? No.
No, with one exception. My father was one of the greatest motivators. When he left the U.S. when the Depression was on, and he went back to Jamaica. He was forced to go back to Jamaica. And he had to take his three kids from the U.S. to Jamaica, and he couldn't afford to put them in school, so he taught them at home. So those kids went from home straight to college.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so that year that we lost in school, you'd when you get home from work at night, you take our books and teach us.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Brilliant. Okay. Let's see if I can get any of you to remember of any best friends and things you like to do together. This is whether it's early childhood or later. I don't know.
You know, my best friend was later, like when I was in my early teens.
Uh-huh.
And her name was Ina Payne. I remember that one. And we lived everywhere together and did everything together. And then my grandmother moved from that area to another area. And her mother got a spot and moved, so we were together until I left Barbados as friends.
Okay, wow.
Best friends.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are you still in touch with?
No, we lose contact. We're moving in, around. And when I lived in the States, her sister lived there. And at one time, I was in close contact with the sister. The mother came to the States and visited my grandmother.
Yeah.
But I never seen her again.
Because she's in Barbados?
I never went back to Barbados, and she never came to the States.
Wow. Must have been difficult, no?
In the beginning, but after a while.
You get used to it, I guess, yeah. Wow, and what about yourself?
Best friend.
Well, this is interesting, because my best friend was a girl called Phyllis Rose, but she was big compared to the rest of the kids in school. Real tall and pretty, and she was a disciplinarian also. You could get close to her, but if you touch her, she'd shove you away. And But she was like a tutor. She'd help with my schoolwork, and we compare answers and so on. And if the answers didn't match up, she'd tell you, well, let's see who was right before you turn in your work.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd go over each subject, and when we decide, well, both of us should be right, then she'd say, okay, we turn them in. But from the time I left elementary in 1956, and I went on to Clarendon College, and she went to England. So we lost touch, and we didn't. I think parents trained us not to correspond, because they figure you might be writing love letters. That was just about it. So she went to England, never heard what became of her.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years ago, I got to understand she's in New York, and but we never got in touch.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow, both separation stories.
Yeah.
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 Whenever you cross the sea, it seems to happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But we never touched sports, and you did sports, but
you
never asked me on sports.
No. You did sports. Oh, let me know.
Or,
did not leave that out yet.
Our favorite was Chevy Chase.
What was that?
We'd select, in elementary school, we'd select two teams of runners. Each team would try to get the best runners.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have two sets of, the opposing side would have two sets of boundaries, similar to a baseball field. So, the opposing side would have a runner on a boundary, two runners. My side of a runner, your side of a runner. And we start by teasing the runner at the longest point. And if you venture within 50 meters of the opposing side, then the fastest runner on that side would try to get you before you get back to your boundary.
Wow. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Then as soon as the opposing fastest runner take off, then the fastest runner on this side would take off to try and tag that person before you get to his opponent.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling that's why Jamaica turned out such great sprinters. Because we're always running, either to the store, or playing these games.
Yes.
The next was cricket.
Mm-hmm, I had a cricket.
Yeah.
Okay.
In cricket also, you got to be a fast runner.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
No wonder that Jamaica turned out these fabulous sprinters.
Yeah, that's something. Yeah. What was the name of the first one?
Chevy Chase.
Chevy Chase.
Yeah.
Like that. Chevy.
So secondary was a different level of secondary school.
Uh-huh.
We got all the sports, soccer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we started real track and field.
Mm-hmm.
And we got they come go to the U.S. for the once again. We have some relays in the state, like pen relays.
Okay, I don't
really
follow, but
like pen relays. The people from the West Indies come up in pen relays.
Something like a Pan American Games, but in
the
U.S.
lower level.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you think of the Jamaican team that did the bobsledding?
Bobsledding. Remember
that?
You did the Winter Olympics.
That's funny.
I never thought I'd live to see the day or hear that Jamaica was participating in bobsledding. We don't have no
snow
or cold weather.
Well,
that was interesting.
Yeah, they're interesting. They got there at least. Yeah. All right, that's great. Let's see. What aspects of the culture of where you were born and raised, Barbados, Jamaica, do you remember the most fondly? What would you say? Aspects of the cultural aspects, first and foremost.
Well, we had a thing we used to call exhibitions, where you would exhibit whatever you had, you know, like people that had beehives, they would exhibit honey, and dressmakers would do the dresses. And
so like crafts and art.
And that was an annual thing.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody, the whole country looked forward to that.
Kind of like a fair?
More or less, like a fair. Yeah, like a fair or mini circus. Mm-hmm. You had animals and that was nice. A real, everybody was there.
Where did they do it exactly?
There is a big place, like a park. I can't remember that park. But it was a park, big park, that everything was enclosed in there. You have to pay an entrance fee.
Mm-hmm.
But the exhibitors didn't pay anything. And at the end of everything, then they sold the product. And that was something as a child I looked forward to every year.
The people from all over Barbados would come?
All over Barbados, yes, in the city that was held.
Wow. Awesome. What, you said the name of the city?
Bridgetown.
Bridgetown.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Ours was the big area was the Denby Show.
Denby Show?
B-E-N-B-I-G-H, I think. Denby Show. It's a big agricultural show, but not only agriculture, but all the needlework and the crafts and the pottery. Then they tie in the fairs and so on. But it was very interesting because it was an island thing. The whole island would come to the show, and you'd see all the big Brahman cattle and the pineapples, the bananas, and some of your fruits and products displayed. And the entrepreneurs would bring their arts and crafts, and those who had interest in exhibits such as sauces and cakes, and even aspiring engineers would bring out their little inventions. And this was great for the kids, because we look forward to seeing what people had in mind for the future, and so on. So this was a big attraction for us.
Denby Show.
Denby Show.
You know where that name Denby comes from?
It's an area in Clarendon, around Maypen,
okay.
And the area was called Denby.
Okay.
So this was used for the showground.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And that was a big thing that I had liked.
May Day.
The first of May.
Mm-hmm.
To be a big fair.
Uh-huh.
And that's where the girls danced the maypole.
The maypole.
And then the guys would climb this pole. Uh-huh. They would grease it.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
They put a ham on the top. and grease the pool. Whoever gets in the top gets the ham.
Wow.
And they go up and slide.
Uh-huh.
But of course, when the last one gets there, they have to slide all that grease
exactly,
off.
Exactly, exactly.
That was
wow.
a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Those were the days, you know,
yeah. Uh-huh. Okay, let me just pause for a second. Actually, I won't pause. So, yes, we're going to do photography here. You can tell me if this works, if the setup works. And as we feel, we will just probably walk around with
okay.
them.
Okay. Just as my ears sticking out.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, now you're making me think of mine. Okay. All right, we're going to continue. Oh, okay. Tell me about, you told me a little bit, now you can tell me a little bit more about your parents and your grandparents. What were they like and where were they from, if it was somewhere other than your own place of birth?
No, my great-great grandmother, my grandmother's grandmother, mm-hmm. came from Syria, Africa. As a slave. That's as far back as I could go there. And on my father's side, his grandfather came from England. Can't go any further back there. I don't know if he was English. He may have been English because the name was Gale. So he may have been English. Mm-hmm. I don't know too much about either side. Mm-hmm. Past
the
grandparents.
Okay. And what about your parents?
My parents born and raised in Barbados.
Mm-hmm. In the same town you were born?
Yeah. St. Mm-hmm. Michael.
Okay. Right. And what were they like?
What were they like? Parents. both of them were travelers, so I raised with my grandmother. My father was always going off somewhere, and my mother was always going off somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was left with my grandmother.
Yes. So they were travelers.
They were travelers.
Yeah.
Almost all Barbadians are travelers.
Yeah. Yeah. Any particular part that they travel most to?
My mother went to Trinidad and Guyana.
Mm-hmm.
We had relatives over there. My father went to the States, and I think he went to Canada at one point, because I know for sure he went to the States.
Okay. Wow.
Well, my grandparents, my grandfather from on my mother's side, was first generation Jamaican. His father was brought as a slave from Ghana, and I think, no, for sure, both were Maroons. I don't know if you know the history of the Maroons. They were Maroons, so they didn't put in any time as work as in slavery. They revolted. But my grandfather told me that the practices of slavery still existed when he was born. He was born just after slavery was abolished. Slavery was abolished in 1838, and he was born just about 1852. So everything was being exercised as it was in slavery.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't take part in the work that the slaves did. And my mother was born, I think, in a different area than my father. My grandfather was born in an area called Westland, which is from Mount Timas in Clarendon. This was a slave property was close by. My mother was born where I was born, in Dawkins, Clarendon. On my father's side, my my grandfather came from Manchester, which was the original either landing place of the MacLeans who came out of Scotland. But my grandfather moved to another area, to Smithville, and that's where my father was born. And my father moved from there when he came back from the U.S. during the Depression. He moved from there to Mokum, where I was born.
Okay. Tell me a little bit more about your family that pretty much were Maroons, that did not necessarily... Well, and this was your father's side or your mother's side?
That's not my mother's side.
Your mother's side.
Yeah.
Do they have, let's see, what part of Jamaica were they living? What settlements? In Panama, we call the settlements of the Maroons Palenques. Was there a particular name that was given to the areas where
There were three areas that were given to the Maroons. Akompong Town, Nani Town, and Kodja Town. The closest area to us was Kodja Town, but Kodja Town was in Portland, between Portland and St. Mary, but because I think they ran off and they were never really in one of the towns. They just refused to work and ran into the hills and nobody could find them. So they were really confined to one of the towns, but I guess they pledged their allegiance to Kodja Town.
Okay. Wow. That's really interesting. What do you know has happened to further descendants like yourself of Maroons? Have there been any movements to recognize this particular group to this day that you know of? The town, those towns, those places? Are there any...
There's only one in existence today. It's one in St. Lisbon. I come from town. They're still practicing their way of life as they did in Africa to this day. So that area is considered an area of natural interest. A lot of tourists go there, and the lifestyle is just like they lived in Africa.
Wow. Is the government recognized?
Yeah, fully.
Okay.
Yeah, because when the treaties were signed in England, with Queen Victoria and Champernani was the ruler, and this is a woman. But I guess she was scared to go to England to sign the treaty because she couldn't trust the English, so she sent Kodjo, which was her chief, and he signed the treaties, and they gave them full rights to have their own government. And today, Akompong Town exists.
Wow.
Yeah, all the others just disintegrated.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very interesting. What were the professions of your parents and grandparents?
Ooh. No. My father was a dentist. My mother was a dressmaker. My grandmother was a midwife. My great grandmother was a midwife. Who did I leave off? It's on that side. On the other side, my father's father, he was a fisherman. And I don't know past him. And my father's mother, she was, I don't know if you call her a housewife, but she had land that she. Farmer.
Mm-hmm.
She
used
to plant stuff. Yep. Okay.
Great. And this is my family. Your parents and grandparents.
On my mother's side, my mother was a housewife. My grandfather was a carpenter. Further back, I live with Trace. On my father's side, my father was a musician. When he went to the U.S., that's all he did. He studied all the string instruments, but he specialized in the violin. So when he returned, when he went back to Jamaica, he said he couldn't do manual work because he had to take injections to make his limbs flexible so he could play the violin. And when he went back, nobody could appreciate classical music, but the rich Jews and the colleges like George's and so on, so and the churches. So that's all he had to do before he started working with the government, play music for the upper class, more or less.
Wow. What kind of injections were these?
I guess hormones. Okay. Hormone injections.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Did your parents or grandparents have any particular mantras or sayings that they repeated to you over and over again to guide your behavior or way of life? Could you share a particular instance when you did something where they needed to say one of these sayings?
My grandmother and her friends come over and they're talking, and I'm around. She would say to the friend, "Little Pilcher has wide ear holes." And I'm telling them, I am there, I might be listening.
Mm-hmm. Wide ear holes. So you were always there trying to.
Well, it was just a talk.
Yeah.
Oh, listen, Jack, why are you home? I'm there.
Right,
I
right.
I hear everything. But then she send me into a room and I hear everything. I'm in the room, but they're not whispering. So I hear everything.
Sound travels, yeah. Like, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Nice. Mr. McLyman, how about you?
Well, my mother did very little talking, but her important thing was about your honesty and chiefly money. So the kids, we'd get a whipping every day for money. She'd say, "Who removed my shilling?" "But Mom, you didn't put a shilling down there." "So no, I'm a liar. All of you get in that room." So we get in that room and we get our whipping every day, which was real because we had a dog, and each time she'd get in the room, the dog would come in the room. And as soon as she picked the strap up, the dog would grab the strap from behind.
Wow.
Yeah, this is a German Shepherd. Really smart. Grab the strap. Right? So then the others would run under the bed. So this would last for about half an hour trying to whip five boys, and she didn't get the first stroke in yet.
Because the dog thought she was playing.
So after half an hour, she'd break down, fall on the bed, break down in laughter.
Yes.
And that's the end of that day. Then
wow.
Tomorrow we go through the same
thing again.
Again. But it proved to be something good that she did, because to this day, I envy nobody for their money. If I choose to work for you and you're a millionaire and I agree at 50 cents an hour, that's good. That's all I look forward to. And I couldn't touch your money. So I think that was a great blessing that she straightened us out on honesty and money.
Mm-hmm.
And my father said he was a great motivator. He was a great motivator. He worked during the day, and at night when he get home, he would eat his food or go to sleep before all the kids. He's got to wake all the kids, come to the dining table. Then he'd ask each one to take a little bit of his food and say, "Are you full?" "Yes." Then he'd eat. the race. Then he sing your song and play your tune on the violin. And words was great thing with him. Yeah, he would always recite something to you in poetry, and he'd always end up saying, "Sans eyes, sans ears, sans teeth, sans everything." So where do you get that from, Daddy? I think he said Omar Khayyam. Then he would. He would say little things like, he would always recite this one. That great men all the lives of great men all reminds us that we can make our lives sublime, and in departing leave behind us footprints on the sands of time. He would be in and up day and day of night. And so when we grew up, we learned that you should make your life constructive so that your children can look at your lifestyle and use that as a motivation, something to motivate them to aspire in life. Mm-hmm. And the next thing he would talk to me in the mornings. I don't know why he chose me, but every morning he'd get up and ask, "Is your mother okay? Take care of your mother." And I guess the reason he did this was because he took me when I was 3.5 years old for my mother. And something he was trying to tell me. It didn't hit me until I was 5 years old. I realized that my mother was 4. And he wanted to say, "Do something about that." And when I got 5, I started taking a half of my dinner to my mother. And by the time I got 9 years old, I was buying clothes for my little brothers and sisters. And by the time I got 12 years old and got to college, I started saving all my pocket money, and I'd buy goats at the end of the school term and give to my mother. Mm-hmm. So when I left high school, she didn't have land enough for the goats to run on. Wow. So I really appreciate what he did. Motivated me.
Yeah. Did you live in the same home with your mother and your father? I mean, your...
No.
Okay.
So, my father was never married to my mother.
Okay. Yes. Oh, very good. Wow. I have a question about Omar Khayyam saying. What is the meaning of the saying he says?
It says, "Sans eyes, sans ears, sans teeth, sans everything." I think he's telling you, be careful of what you hear, be careful of what you see, and the tongue, the teeth is what controls the movement of the tongue. Be careful of what you say, your words cannot be taken back. He say, the things you see, make sure you look at the right things, because there are some things you see that if you practice those, it might lead you down the wrong track. Your ears, try to hear the right things so you can put them into practice.
Okay. Great. Okay. All right. Does anybody want to take a break, drink some water? You're good. All right. Okay, excellent. We're going to move on to the culture questions. What type of music did you grow up hearing? Who were your favorite singers, and what are your favorite songs? And you know, if I'm asking you about music, I may ask you something else also, right? So we can start with, yes, what did you hear singing and favorite singers? Songs, names of songs, favorite songs.
Each is on, I used to like that. And I think that was about Pat Boo. And he had a book with all of them. He used to write them down. No, I'm here. I can't remember
that. Can you remember a lyric for any songs? Would you like to sing?
Sparrow.
Oh,
right. Yeah, Sparrow is all his calypso song because Barbados is calypso and Jamaica is reggae. And my head is not working.
Well, that's fine. I can come back to you if you remember later. You can also tell me.
Okay,
Mr. McLaren.
Well, at home, because my father played classical music, he played these tunes on the violin, and really as kids at that time, we couldn't appreciate the classical music, but he was such a great artist that we loved to listen because on the four strings, it would appear as if each string was the sound of a singer. So it sounded more like what we call the music without instruments,
a cappella.
So much like a cappella. So we pay a lot of attention to that. But he got us interested in listening to this gospel singer, what's her name? The one I love. American, Mahalia Jackson. Yeah. So she became our favorite as from his point of view, from his type of music. So we love Mahalia. When I got to the States, I even tried to find out where she lived. She died shortly after I got to the States, and to this day, she's my favorite gospel singer. But on the other side, when we came up, rock and roll was just breaking in. I think the Jitterbug and Calypso was getting out of the liking, so rock and roll came in, and oh, that was something else.
Yeah, rock and roll by whom?
Well,
anyway.
Listen, our Elvis Presley was great, and Fats Domino was great. Yeah, Professor Long here. But the great one was Little Richard.
Oh, he loved it.
Yes, Little Richard to this day. Little Richard, at that time, Paola was in the States, and you don't know what Paola is.
No.
Paola was a payoff system where if you had a good record, you want this jockey to promote your record. So this jockey would take a little money on the side to promote your record. And the great promoter time. I'll tell you in a minute. He got caught for payola, and he got heartbroken and died shortly after. I'll tell you in a minute his name. But little Richard, as he claims to the, he claims at that time he was a father, rock and roll, and he figured he deserved a higher rating than Elvis. So, but he was great. He was great. Little Richard, then the Everly Brothers, the Browns, Johnny and the Hurricanes. It was a great era.
Any favorite songs? Particular songs?
What? Little Richard. Oh, you make me dizzy, Miss Lizzie. When you rock and roll. Then, yeah. I think when his girlfriend left him, and I think he got heartbroken, so he wrote a song, I Can't Believe You Won't Go. And that was one of the great ones. Yeah. Then Lucia was in there. Then I think when his girlfriend left, he wrote another song, Send Me Some Loving. And that was another great hit. Then Elvis Presley, I think Jailhouse Rock, Jailhouse Rock was one of my favorites. And my real favorite was Elvis was I come back to that one. But Professor Long here, then
Return to Sender, I like that one.
Yeah.
Can't have fallen in love.
Mm-hmm. Good.
The Everly Brothers, all his songs were great. The Everly Brothers.
Elvis, yeah. I remember you like
that. All great. Devoted to You was one of my favorites from the Everly Brothers. And then, who was the guitarist? There was a group when Elvis had some two of his great guitarists left him. I think Bill Black. Then Bill Black formed a little combo called the Blink Bill Black combo. That was great. Guitarist. I forgot the name of his other guitarist. Left in the mud. The rock and roll era was really great because, Little Richard played a great role in the rock and roll era. I remember when the Beatles were getting off the ground. The Beatles sent for Little Richard. You should see Little Richard when he jumped on top of that piano in England. Yeah, that really took Beatles took off from them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this, you're experiencing all of this in Jamaica.
Yeah,
right?
In Jamaica. Mm-hmm. Because at that time we pick up most of our music from a station in Miami, WINZ, coming over with Bob Green, Armory. Yeah, so that's how we got into rock and roll. But it was something you just couldn't resist.
Rock and roll is good, definitely. All right. Well, I asked you about this a little bit before, but in case you remember any others, favorite games. I know you told me about sports that you like to play, right? Cricket and Chevy Chase. And I know you. Sports you were doing. Any other favorite games you can think of that you'd like to tell me about?
Well, boys played marbles, and we played marbles for cashew, which is marañón. Uh-huh. Yeah, because there weren't a lot of cashew trees, and cashew was a favorite, so you'd play your marbles for cashew, and when you win, you get the take of the cashews.
Wow. And cashews are still expensive today.
Yeah, still expensive. Yeah. Then we had basketball. Uh, Morris, that's, Morris concentrated on running.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was kind of sick, and so I didn't do a lot until I was a teenager, and then I was able to spring sports in school, but when I was growing up smaller, you know, I wasn't allowed to do too much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I was sick.
Yeah.
Well, in secondary school, when we got the clarinet cards, then we got exposed to the wider games, you know, like soccer on a higher level, cricket on a higher level, track and field on a higher level, and cricket, track and field, yeah. So those are the games. We had great motivation because when you step back to the late 30s, 40s, we had great track and field competitors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like Herb McKinley, Wint, and Roden, so on. These are people who set world records, so we had something to look forward to. So, In the 50s, I think secondary schools took off in Jamaica in the 50s, because prior to that, only the rich could afford to send their kids to school. But just around 1955, 56, Norman Manley, who was the father of Michael, gave Jamaica a grant for 10,000 scholarships. And so the poor could get their kids into schools, and then the poor kids now were the great runners, so that's when track and field really took off in Jamaica.
Great. Okay, well, do you like to eat? What are your favorite foods?
My favorite is curry chicken. Or curry anything.
Yes.
I like curry. With pepper.
Hot curry.
Hot curry.
Do you know? Do you prepare?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to go visit you then.
Yes.
And it's so
fun. Well, our favorites, I love to eat, but I try to control my eating. Yeah, usually 3 meals a day, and but now that I'm retired, 2 meals is sufficient, because when I was working, you could work it off. But now we got to eat a little less. And as Jamaicans, we eat a lot. Yeah, we eat 3 heavy meals in Jamaica. And our favorites are for breakfast, we usually eat bananas, plantains, usually ackee, codfish, or we like a lot of liver. Lunchtime.
Same thing.
Back to the natural foods. You call it ground food. Yeah. Heavy meals. Yeah. We drink a lot of fresh fruits, juices. Yeah, we concentrate on that. A lot of fresh juice. Not too much soda.
Mm.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Alright.
Fish, we eat a lot of fish, and of course, the Jamaican jerk pork and the favorite, yeah,
mm-hmm.
A lot of patties and all that.
The jerk pork, I'm wondering, do you or Mrs. McClement, we didn't get jerk pork in Panama. My father's family generation that came to Panama didn't get jerk pork. When the jerk pork start in Jamaica? Because that's
well,
so odd.
I think pork was a novelty way back, and formerly they would smoke the pork. They would build a smokehouse and smoke the pork. But I think somewhere in the late 40s, early 50s, somebody experimented with jerk pork. And to make it really tasty, you have to use a wood called pimento. Pimento is the spice. And you have to use that wood to give it the flavor. And as far as I can remember, jerk pork started in Portland. Portland area. I can't remember the exact the name of the area, but Boston. Boston, an area called Boston. That's where the jerking started. And it moved from there into other areas. So Boston is the thing. Boston jerk pork.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, thank you.
That's awesome. I think that's the area where Errol Flynn had his property.
Mm-hmm.
Boston States.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
What were your favorite cultural figures or heroes as a child, and what do you remember or know about them?
Our favorite was Louise Bennett. And Ronnie Williams.
Ronnie Williams?
Yeah. Then you had the Bim and Bam Show. Yeah. The Bim and Bam Show. They were rivals to Louise Bennett and Ronnie Williams. But when I think Bim and Bam migrated to England, between the late 50s and the early 60s, so after them, then people like Oliver and others broke into the show. But Louise Bennett and Ronnie Williams took the show and held it for a long period of time.
Okay, tell me a little bit about each of those, Louise Bennett and Ronnie Williams. Exactly who were they? What did they do? What kind of shows did they do? What was their focus?
Well, the big shows were the pantomimes. And I think in the pantomimes, they also did a dancing similar to the ones in Panama, which was a quadrille. They wore something similar to the pollera. During these pantomimes, you have the competitive dancers in quadrille, and then you have Louise Bennett and Ronnie Williams show, which was just like comics,
more
to speak.
Comedy.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Comedy, more comedy. And along with the comedy, they have little groups of singers who sang in cultural songs, which were handed down from slavery songs that are remembered from Africa. This was what they did in the pantomimes.
Okay. Huh. What was particularly special about Louise Bennett and Ronnie Williams? What stood out about them compared to other comedians?
I think they had something fresh to offer each time they appeared. They didn't have too much competition at the time, so people looked forward to seeing or hearing them on the radio. And we didn't have television at the time, so if you couldn't get to the pantomime, which was always in Kingston, you had to listen to the radio, or the radio fusion, which came before the radio. So people living out in the country that couldn't see them didn't really have something visually to appreciate. So what we appreciated was the fact that they were there to offer something. And that's just about all I can remember about appreciation, because I couldn't get to the shows.
Right. Mrs. McClellan, would you like to add
anything? What we had in Barbados is what you call a service, a song. And it was a group of men and women that go around singing. If you had a death in the family, they'll come around and spend the night with you and sing, or a cappella. But it was beautiful. The different tones, the voices, and the harmony, oh, it was really good. You know, sir, in Barbados?
Yeah.
Yeah. And weddings, they sang at weddings, and different occasions. And these were the older people. The young people did not do it. As a young person, I come up seeing it. By the time I got an adult, it was all finished. Because the young people did not pick it up. That was great. No instruments at all.
Wow.
Yes. And they could sing.
To this day, wherever they go in the world,
they could sing.
Bay gents can sing.
They can sing.
Yeah. I got something of interest that wasn't considered a culture, so to speak, but it was a culture, was the professional singers at funerals and what we call setups and
nine nights.
See, when someone died, you had to try and keep the family intact by being there as a support in the community. So these singers in the community would come and sing prior to the funeral. They'd sing maybe two or three nights, and it was a feature attraction, because you didn't hear stuff like this until there was a funeral. And 9 days after the funeral was another series of singing. They would call this the ninth night, and these singers would come out and sing again. It was really interesting, because their singing was such a beauty to the ear, that you look forward to it. You didn't look forward to a funeral or a death, but just the singing. And they had to be supplied with the coffee, the rum, the fried fish, the bread to keep them singing. And what was amusing about this, you know, was when they figure it's time for food or drink, they come up with a chorus. A man can't sing without coffee. So, in order to keep them singing, the coffee had better come up. Then, a man can't sing without rum. The rum had better come up. Or, a man can't sing without fried fish. It better come up. So, when these singers come out, you know, your duty is to provide them with coffee, rum, bread, and fish.
I don't know what was meant, but in Barbados, it's free. You didn't have to pay them. Pay them anything. They have to eat. Right? Yeah. Food to eat. No money passed. But the young people, they didn't.
Well, that was a culture. That was part of our culture.
Wow. Yeah.
Maybe still is.
Reminds me a little bit, I don't know too much about it, but I know, I guess in New Orleans, for funerals, they have like this procession, and I wonder if there's any relation at all to the idea. I don't know how much time they do it for, but ninth night, is there a reason for the ninth of, in particular, after the funeral?
I don't know if this is an African culture. It might be an African culture, because there was so much superstition that maybe it was a hand-me-down culture from America. I don't know if the English practice anything like that. I don't know.
No,
but I know in Jamaica they do practice that. Maybe to this day they still do.
Okay. Well, you've already mentioned to me some of the people I'll ask you about in this next question, if there's anything more. Have you ever heard of Louise Bennett? I know you have. Mighty Sparrow, you've mentioned before. What thoughts, if any, come to mind when you hear their names? Have you actually seen them perform live? And if so, what do you remember about the performances, words, or lyrics? I know you said you only heard Louise Bennett on the radio, and I don't know if you've actually
seen
him.
Yeah, I've seen him in Barbados, and I've seen him in Trinidad.
Okay.
What do you remember? His music is good, and he had a lot of funny songs. Sing about a lot of his girlfriends. And one of them is one of them. I come to interview and stuff like that, I lose everything.
Okay.
I'm not good.
Don't worry.
All the things that I know is just gone.
Yeah. I understand.
Because I have the records at home and I play right. them all the time, and now I don't remember one name or
yeah, the spot, yeah.
not even the first line of anything.
tell your sister to come home. Boy, I have something here for she. You don't remember that one.
How about you?
What was the question?
Well, Louise Bennett and Sparrow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what do you remember about them if you have?
The thing that impressed me most about them is that their comedy was comedy that you could expose to children, grown-ups. It was clean comedy, as opposed to comedy today, where you got foul language. Nothing. Comedy today is something I wouldn't want my children to listen. But comedy at that time was clean. And it helped you, in that time, it helped you to look forward to anything with the family of Jamaica. An evening where you could sit with your mother and father and listen to something that they would appreciate. And that's what impressed me most about them. The clean comedy.
Okay. Do you have any contact with the U.S. or the U.K. culture as a youth? And what do you remember about that? I know you mentioned some of the musicians, right? Some of the rock and roll era and so forth. But any other additional, you know, contact cultural things that you got from either the U.S. or England as a youth?
From England, culturally, I can remember what my grandfather taught me. I was just about 3 years old when I was still around my grandfather. But he had a large history book, and this book contained everything from slavery to the acts of Queen Victoria, I think Henry VIII, the piracy trade in throughout the West Indies and South America, and he would read to me everything from the book, and he It's amazing how some of those things still remain in my memory from 3 years old. You tell you the things that Queen Victoria did. I think it's a fact. She had one breast. She had some disease, so she had to cut one breast off, and she made a lot of women in England cut a breast off because she had one. And but for the culture, the acts of the Maroons and the signing of a treaty with Queen Victoria, something that's really stand out in my mind, because he would tell us, and my father told us the same thing, try and give your labor to your family. In other words, try to work as a family. When you grow up, stick together. And culturally, we find a breakdown today that blacks are not willing to work with their own to build your race or keep your race at a certain level. We'd rather give our labor away. And that's important for our culture. And the first black parliamentarian in England, a woman, is my first cousin. See, when she went to England in the 50s, she was a good reader, writer, and when she went to England in the 50s, mostly the people who migrated weren't able to read or write too well. And she lived in the area they lived in, Brixton, and she would write letters for these people who couldn't read and write. So down the road, someone asked her, why don't you get a little cardboard box and go run for politics? She did, and she became the first parliamentarian. So it's culturally, these are some of the things you develop from your parents through the Royal Crown Reader. Because when the Anansi story stepped in, then they more or less bridged you away from cultural things that were really motivating.
Anything like that?
Well, I went to London, England when I was 22 years old. And at the time I was there, when I got there, there were not a lot of black people there. So the place that he just mentioned, Brixton, mm-hmm. that was where most of the black people were. And that is where you could get the type of things that you're looking for, like pantyhose,
mm-hmm.
couldn't get pantyhose for my color.
Mm-hmm.
I could get very light ones that didn't look right on my legs. And we used to dye the stockings in coffee grounds or tea bags. But still didn't come right. And then we started selling them for our color in Brixton. So everything that we needed, we used to go to Brixton. That was the place that black people got all their stuff. Until eventually the stores at the places started to cater to us. But in the beginning, nothing.
You didn't mention the
dead boy?
Culturally, the dead colors that were used in England before the West Indians and the Africans went in. It was the Africans and the West Indians who dyed the pantyhoses and wore these fabulous colors that motivated the English to switch from the black
everything,
black coat, black suits to these colorful suits and dresses. Mm-hmm. So culturally,
we made a change.
Yeah, the doctors made a change.
Do you think that's something that's recognized to this day?
I doubt it.
For us, we recognize that we drive the culture.
Those that follow us, the first thing that going found it pretty easy because they could find what they're looking for and they could find housing because at one point we couldn't find good housing, you know, especially if you had children. If you had children, you couldn't find anywhere to rent. First, you would see it in the window, no children. So don't even ask about that apartment. Things like that.
Well, you asked about the appreciation. You were asking if England really appreciated what the blacks did to bring this culture into. I'm not sure if they. If they admit that they appreciate it, but I know they ought to admit that they appreciate it because it brought them revenues.
Right. Yeah. One thing I could say about England, the laws were very, very fair. Doesn't matter what color. Because when I first went there, there were these guys, young white guys, call themselves the Teddy Boys. And at that time they used to wear the shoes pointed. They call them wrinkle pickers. And I could remember that there was an outburst of attacking black people and they would kick you in those pointed shoes. And there were six of them. And they were brought before the judge. And when he heard the complaint, he said, 3 years for everybody. Don't want to hear anything, just 3 years. And they went to jail for 3 years. And that was the first and the last. Mm-hmm. Now you see, America is a little different. It would not have happened.
Not like that.
It would not have happened. So, I at that time when I was there, I thought the law was fair. I don't know what it is now.
How many years were you in England?
I was there 8 years.
Okay. All right. I'm going to talk a little bit about migration. Now, did your parents and grandparents ever have to choose to migrate from one place to another? And if so, do you know what may have prompted them to do so? I know you told me your parents were from the same area you were. But I think maybe Mr. McClement, you might have mentioned. Sure.
Okay, you go ahead.
Go ahead.
And when I come back on.
No problem. Yes. They ever have to move.
As I told you, my mother used to go to Trinidad and Guyana, and my father, he went to America and Canada. He went to America to train to take that dentistry course.
Okay.
And when he finished, he came back to Maryland.
Uh-huh.
And he never lived abroad after that.
Mm.
He visited, but he never lived abroad. But my mother lived in the States. She lived in the United States until she died.
Mm, yeah. Okay.
So my grandmother, she left Barbados when she was 63.
Hmm.
And at that time I was living in Jamaica. So she spent a little while with me in Jamaica and then she went to the United States for my mother and she died there.
Why did she, let's start with your mother traveling to Trinidad and Guyana. Why did she travel?
Well, we had relatives there. No, well, we had relatives in Guyana. But she used to go to Trinidad to the carnival, and then if she got work there, because I told you she was a dressmaker, so she would work and help make the costumes and stuff like that, and then she'd come back.
Okay.
And she never chose to take me because she said that in those days, carnival was very dangerous. The groups used to come, people used to fight each other and cut up. And so she would say, "Girl, I can't run with you, but I have to run.
Uh-huh.
You know, I need to be free to run." So she would bring pictures back to me, but she never took me. And then, as I told you, my grandmother came to the States late in her life.
Why did she move to the States?
Well, she moved to the States because my mother was her only child, and my mother lived in the States. Unfortunately, as soon as she got to the States, my mother died. So she lived with me until she died.
Yes, so we were looking at travel and migration. Did any of your parents or grandparents ever have to migrate or travel away from where they live? And why?
My grandfather was a farmer, and he took his produce from the country to Kingston. So that's as far as, and he went back home every weekend, so this was to support the family. But on my father's side, by the time he got to my father, migration became a necessity because the parents educated their children, and there was no means for the use of your education in Jamaica at the time. So they had no choice but to migrate to countries that were offering jobs and those resources that would enable them to support a family. So at the time my father migrated, Cuba was a choice for Jamaicans, I think chiefly because they had learned so much about slavery and the prejudicial practices in America. So for the reason of slavery, they didn't want to go to migrate to England because these were your slave masters. I don't want to go there. As far as America, at the time my father migrated, America was opening up. It was just around the turn of the century, the 20th century, when Europeans were moving to America. But they had learned that prejudice existed so much in America that it wasn't their first choice. Cuba was a place to go because the slaves, there was a time when the slaves in Jamaica ran off to Cuba when the English came. So they figured with their relatives in Cuba, and Cuba was progressing because I think the mafia had just moved into Cuba, so they could make a living in Cuba. Some migrated to, some of my uncles migrated to Cuba. So my father took off to Cuba, not solely because he wanted to go, but he was the help on the buggy that my grandfather used to Kingston. And one evening on the trip to Kingston, my father fell asleep at the reins, and his father woke up from in the back of the buggy, realized the horses are cantering down the hill. So he used the horse whip and gave him a stroke to wake him up. He said that stroke stung him so bad, he took off and went back home. Well, that was his mistake. And when my grandfather returned on the weekend, he gave him a whipping. He said, when he got that whipping, he said, he didn't think he could take another one like that in life, so he better take off. So his mother packed him and sent him to Cuba, where his brothers and sisters were. He was only 14 years old.
Wow.
So he He left home at 14 to start a life as a man for himself. So he went to Cuba, and he said he didn't like Cuba, so he jumped on the next boat. He went to Miami. He said he walked around in Miami for a half a day, and he realized that was not the place for a black man in 1917. So he jumped on the next ship, New York. So he got to New York, he looked around, and said, I think I can survive here. So he stayed in New York. So migration was good for him because he learned a lot in New York. And
on the way.
Yes.
Great, thank you. Okay. Now, both of you talked to me about family members who migrated. Now, when they migrated to these other places, did the culture, did they find that the culture in that place they moved to be completely different from where they came from? And what did they tell you about those experiences? You hinted at some of this when you're talking about where he went to Cuba and then Miami and then New York. But is there any other, information?
Apparently, in all the islands, the culture is almost the same, just little differences. We are all from Africa, and, we have the same type of food, the same eating habits, we're all the same. Like Panama here, no different. We the same fried plantain.
Right.
And the only thing you don't have enough here is like sweet potato. We eat a lot of sweet potato in Barbados, but you don't find a lot of it here in Panama. And ackee.
Yeah.
Don't find a lot of it here in Panama. There are a lot of trees, but the fruit of itself, you don't find it. But there are the trees, so we know that culture is here. And breadfruit. We have breadfruit trees here. And we eat a lot of yuca home. Fried fish, steamed fish, dried fish.
How about when... Who was it who moved to the States before?
My mother.
Okay, and then your grandmother.
And then my grandmother.
How was that move for her? What did you talk about that?
My grandmother?
Yeah.
Oh, she loved it. So she gets to travel... When she was in her 60s, first she went to Jamaica, then to Barbados, and then to America. And she really enjoyed it.
Where in the U.S. did she go?
Queens.
Okay, New York. And Mr. McMahon, how about yourself?
From what I gathered from those who migrated, their contribution to the countries they went to was as a result of what they learned from slavery. We couldn't progress in slavery as a race because we were deprived of our languages, our cultures from Africa, and in the same light when those who migrated to places like England got to England, they found that they weren't treated as they wanted to be treated, or as they were treated in Jamaica. So they had to form groups and more or less incite the other immigrants around them to rise up and make a difference. So I think that's one reason that Dion Abbott became a parliamentarian in England. And see, when when she left her home in Jamaica, with her education, I guess she believed when she got to England, she could advance. But when you get there and you see your fellow countrymen not being able to advance, it become a part of you to help to motivate them. And in order to motivate people at that time in England, you had to be in politics. So she got in politics and did a work for the people in that area. On my father's side, on my father, she's a cousin. On my father's side, when my father got to America, he got there at the time when Marcus Garvey was moving blacks from the south to the north. So he had to be involved with the Marcus Garvey movement. And culturally, you had to do something, because we learned from one of the great sayings of this Chinese I'll give it a minute. The worst thing you can do, or one of the worst things you can stand and look at, is to look at people bowing to tyranny, just like the grass bowing to the wind. You can't sit there and not do something. It's your God-given right to do something. So my father joined the Marcus Garvey movement in Harlem, and the Back to Africa movement, and it was culturally, it was the thing to do. And I really appreciate. What year? Mm-hmm. No, you got to New York in 1970. Mm-hmm. You got to New York in 1970. And that Marcus Garvey movement was strong in Harlem in 1925. Mm-hmm. Very strong. And my father was in Harlem at the time.
Okay.
Yes.
Considering what you've told me about the things that they have to do to adjust because of the situation, to join these groups or form groups to raise awareness, did they find a culture in this new place different from theirs? I know in your case we're talking about foods being very similar across the Caribbean and so forth. Over here we're talking about family moving to Harlem, the U.S., or in the case of the person who went to England, right? And they were pretty proactive about working to deal with that. What would be the main differences they might have brought up as far as a need to bring these groups together?
The main difference
mm-hmm.
is they
the main
might
difference
have
is in culture, right? It would make them. Yeah.
I think the difference is in culture. I don't want to stress on food. I think in culture differences would be to be self-sufficient, to produce products that you use, as opposed to products that are offered to you that you're not familiar with, or products you would not want to use. One of my uncles, when he got to the States, he started making cosmetic products, mm-hmm. and he formed a cosmetic company, built it in California, to produce the things that black people use. In England, it would be more or less, on my family side in England, might have been foods, but I don't have a recollection of any family member in England who started their own, I know, furniture company. They started in England and the U.S. furniture companies, because I guess they want to use the furniture that they're culturally acquainted with and accustomed to. And these are furniture that they would have patterned off furniture they use in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this would have been a way to maintain the culture of their original home, as you're saying.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, what aspects of that culture or these values that we're talking about here do you think were passed on to you?
Well, it so happens that because the way we're made, we're all unique. As far as these cultures, the only culture that really I acquired or picked up, and I didn't know I was picking up this culture, is that of carpentry. I'm good with making stuff. It never dawned on me why it becomes so easy until one day my mother said, "You realize you work so good with stuff. You realize your grandfather was a top carpenter?" But on the other hand, things my uncles and aunts did, I didn't pick up by. I find myself gifted with the use of the hand, so I can do a lot in the trades, plumbing, welding, work with wood,
mm-hmm.
electricity, all that. Just well, the jack of all trades, but mm-hmm. I don't know where I got that from.
Okay.
One thing I've noticed with my family, wherever they've gone, there are some trades that seem to be easy for them. They're into mechanics and the engineering, the mechanical engineering trades. I find when I find them anywhere in the world, they're always in those trades. Come to Panama, I find those that came here into the same trades. They're into pharmacy, medicine, and the mechanical trades.
Very true. Mr. McCormick, how about yourself? Are there any, we talked about family members traveling, and I guess how they adapted to different places. Some of the places were very similar, but I'm assuming there's some differences also. Are there any aspects of the cultures that they experience in these new places that were passed on to you, or also the ways in which they adapted to these new places that you feel is affected?
Yeah, as I told you, that we're all travelers. As soon as, especially the guys get the 18 Barbados, they leave
mm-hmm.
and go abroad, somewhere, anywhere except Barbados, because it's a small island, very overpopulated. So there is not a lot of work. As soon as you reach a certain age, I can be abroad and make my fortune outside, because you cannot make it in Barbados.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I left that 22.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to England, mm-hmm. worked with London Transport.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And almost all the young people of my age group at that time, leaving and going somewhere. And we can adapt to any culture. It doesn't matter about the food, because we make our own food. If we can get, wherever you go, you can get corn meal, you can get flour, you can get sugar. I I went to England, they have cornmeal, they have flour, they have sugar, I can make dumplings, I can make cornmeal porridge. I can make oats, I can make cereal, you know, and they always have very important fish. I meet a lot of fish in Barbie. A lot of fish in England, there's a lot of fish in America, there's a lot of fish in Panama. So, a lot of fish in Jamaica, those are the places that I live. And I adapt myself to wherever I go. I travel light. I don't look back on what I leave behind. I just look forward all the time. And my mother did the same thing. She left Barbados and told me she was going to Guyana and Trinidad. She left her Trinidad and she went to the United States. Did the same thing. In regards to something you pick up from your parents. My mother was a dressmaker. I'm a dressmaker. She's a beautician. I'm a beautician. The only thing I didn't pick up was her death. She died early and I'm still alive. But other things, I kind of pick up a lot of stuff from her natural thing. And I pick up some of my own, like working in the house, painting, decorating, tiling. I can do a little plumbing, a little electricity, same.
But there are other traits that you're missing.
Like what?
Important traits.
Like what?
They, from a midwife, midwifery running your family.
Yes.
Didn't you wind up as a
EMT?
EMT.
EMT.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, didn't your son become a doctor?
Yes.
So there are unrecognized
traits.
Yeah, that run in the family,
yes.
And sometimes you overlook them, but they are important.
Yes, they're there.
Yeah. It's not just foods.
Right.
It's the traits that run. And culturally, you can consider that form of culture.
Exactly.
Because when you trace these traits, you might find out that your great great grandmother from Sierra Leone was a midwife.
Never know.
Yeah. Yeah. See, she was brought in slavery, but it's more than likely that she wasn't used as a slave because she was a mulatto. Now, they don't bring mulattoes to work in slavery because mulattoes are is what we call pass for white. Right? The slaves were strong black people who could work in slavery.
To take the sun.
Yeah. Now, you're not going to bring a mulatto to work in slavery. It's more than likely she was brought in as for some other reason.
Or in the home.
There were a time when they brought settlers, and settlers' wives are to be wives. So you don't know. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
But I was told she came as a slave.
Yeah.
So I can only go with that.
Right. Right. Okay. Okay. You mentioned you have family that lives overseas. Where are the other places you have family that live right now?
Overseas, you mean like
outside of your original home,
exactly. Yeah, I have some cousins in Canada that can't get in touch with. I don't know where they are. And I have some in England. But because my mother was an only child and my father was an only child, I don't have a lot of relatives. But these that I'm talking about are not my immediate cousins. They're like my mother's.
And the stomach family?
I have two brothers that live in the States.
Oh, you went south, exactly.
Two brothers. They were born there.
Okay.
Yeah, I got family scattered throughout the U.S. Canada, England, Germany. Some in the Middle East. Some throughout the West Indies.
Mm-hmm.
And we find because the family is growing so rapidly, sometimes you don't know exactly where they migrate to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got lots of family here in Panama. These came to build a canal to didn't go back home.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You find, I didn't know they were here until a cousin was passing through. He was on his way to some other country in South America. He stopped in Costa Rica and ran into Juan McLamon. He asked, just coincidentally, and that one informed me that there were lots of McLamons in Panama. So
wow.
I came, I did the research and found out they were here.
Yes. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Large.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I know I have heard the name.
Yeah.
I can't put up my finger on who. But
yeah.
I have heard the name before, definitely.
One was one was a sea captain.
Mm.
And he was a captain on a boat that ventured in, American ship that ventured into Cuban waters. A Castro captured him. Held him for about 7 years before he got out. It cost his wife $70,000 to get him out of Castro's hands. Yeah.
Was he in the U.S. military? Or
no,
he was a captain of
he was
a
sea captain. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing. Well, let's continue along the family. Okay. So, have you yourself ever migrated? I know you have at least one location. What would be the places you have migrated?
Well, I had to live in Barbados for a year because I was going to a cable and wireless training school.
Mm-hmm.
I was centered there, so I stayed there for a year. While I was there, I saw the islands that I mentioned before,
mm-hmm.
like Martinique, Guadeloupe, St. Kitts, Antigua, Puerto Rico. So I don't consider those. It's just passing through,
right.
Not the migration.
Mm-hmm.
Then I moved to the U.S. in 1970. In Canada.
Did you live in Canada for a significant amount of time?
No. Oh, I just visited my children in Canada.
Yes.
So. But for migration, it would be the U.S. and then Panama.
What made you decide to migrate? Barbados, you said it was cable and wireless training.
Yeah.
So what made you decide to migrate to the U.S. and to Panama?
Well, to the U.S., it was partly because of my ambitions. I figured, as a youngster in Jamaica, I didn't see any great hope for progress because the companies that operated in Jamaica provided jobs that were menial in pay and I didn't see how I could get up and buy a decent piece of property, build a house and raise a family because they weren't paying well, and I just decided that you pay me here or pay me over there. So I saw the opportunity to get out and I got out and I was able to do well overseas in the States where I went, and that's what prompted me to migrate to the U.S. Yeah, and it's really shocking that when companies move into these islands or into another country, they move in solely for the purpose of what they can gain, but not how they can use the people to be more productive for themselves. And I couldn't take that sitting down as a youngster, so I had to get out to make it better for me and for my future family.
And what about Fatima? What made you decide to move to Fatima?
Well, I have to give Panama the credit as being a country where the people are really sweet and loving. Really. Really. I have to give them that credit, because when you get to any airport in any country, you can just tell what that country is like or will be like. When I got to the airport in Panama, before I got outside the airport, I read the people up. See, when you grow in life, Mohammed Ali made a remark that if you're the same person you are or were this year as compared to last year, you've lost or wasted a year in your life. So this helped you to be a good judge of people, character, country, and so on when you get to a new country. And when I got to Panama, before I got out of the airport, the people that I was in contact with told me that this is a really sweet country. And I decided, before I got out of the airport, I'm going to retire here.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. So this will help to build the motive of the people. This is something they should never lose. Yeah, their sweetness and the love of their country.
What about you, Mrs. McCormick? What made you decide to migrate? The years you moved to England, you already told me that had to do with just the work.
Yeah.
Exactly. After England, where did you migrate?
To Jamaica. I guess because my first husband was Jamaica.
Okay.
And we moved to America.
And then after Jamaica?
America.
Uh-huh. Okay. And what made you move somewhere?
My mother lived in America and she was ill. And I had already applied for a permanent residence. And when you apply for permanent residence, you cannot get vacation. So I was just praying that I would get my visa to be able to come and be with my mother while she was ill. And I say the Lord did help me to get my visa while she died the next year.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And then I guess it was from the U.S. to Panama.
From the U.S.
And that would be similar to so, yeah.
Well, as he told you, when he got out of the airport, the questions that he was asking was, where is some land to buy, or where is a nice location? And he was asking everybody places to go and see. And the people that we came with were friends that are family.
Mm-hmm.
She invited us to come on vacation. She was coming to visit her mom. So she didn't believe him. Another friend was with her said, he must be crazy. He didn't even spend a day here. Mm-hmm. And he wants to move here.
Yeah.
Asking these type of questions. So she said, well, what about you and you and him? I said, sure, all the way. Mm-hmm. So that's how he decided and I decided behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got back from our vacation to the States, and we told our children and friends and everybody, 95 grand there? I mean, who you know there? What you know about there? And he repeated the same thing. He said that the people are friendly and everything's very nice and the weather is good. And so the next year, we came on vacation again just to make sure you really want to come. So we came in 2004 and looked around. I started the process on our papers. And we moved in 2005.
Wow.
Kind of look back, see?
Right. Okay. That's great. Okay. How did you feel the first time you landed in the different places you've migrated to? So the first time you landed in London, the U.S., Canada.
Excited.
Yeah.
Excited. New place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
New people to meet, new places to see.
Mm-hmm. And what were your expectations of what that would be like?
The only letdown was America. That was the only letdown, because from a child, my mother left when I was about 12 years old, and she would send these beautiful clothes, barrels of this and barrels of that. I always thought that America was the most beautiful place, the most prosperous place. And when I go to America, I'm going to do very, very well, because I'm going to be rich. Mm-hmm. And my letdown was when I got to Manhattan. I stayed in Queens, but I don't know how I got to Manhattan. My mother worked at the hospital in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
So when we got out of the airport, we went that way. And she showed me where she worked at the hospital. She worked at.
Yeah.
Oh, no, okay.
Thank you.
And Manhattan was a mess.
Yeah.
It was streets are dirty, garbage everywhere, people walking without shoes, and a letdown.
Yeah.
I didn't expect to see a white person, because when white people come to Barbados, they're always, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So see a white person walking without shoes.
Was it a homeless situation, or was it just?
May have been. Yeah. You know, I just came. I'm, you know, driving with my mother. Seeing all of this stuff, and then she was telling me how she had to really do stuff out of the trash.
Yeah, in this country.
And then all the buildings are gloomy, look like they need a good coat of paint, nothing looked bright.
Yeah.
But when we got to Queens, then I was a little feeling a little better, because the homes in Queens were nice.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Mm, and in what ways did it, I mean, London, U.S., Panama, meet your expectations? I know U.S. did not meet your expectations for the reason you
London, I was young and I went direct to a job.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't do a lot of traveling around London because I was working.
Yeah.
And I had an opportunity to go to France, but I didn't go because I needed company. I didn't have anyone to company, so I needed people to go to France.
So as far as work is concerned, you got what
work,
you needed.
I worked.
Perfectly.
Yeah.
And then in the U.S., were there any expectations that were met from what you...
As long as you can meet your bills,
mm-hmm.
and you can get something to eat,
mm-hmm.
you can buy your food, I think, rent is one.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot have too many great expectations.
Right.
You just have to survive.
Okay. Now, what about Panama?
But Panama is my retirement.
Yes. It's meeting your expectations, I think.
It's meeting my expectations. We try to travel, building a home.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to travel in between building problems. And when there's no cement and the guys can't work,
mm-hmm.
or the guys working somewhere else,
right,
and have time to come there,
then
we travel, we meet the daddy in, we meet to Boca del Toro, we meet to several functions, and we meet other people that move here, that live in other areas, we go visit, we make our lives full.
Yeah.
And the local people that we live among are very nice, very loving, and very kind. So, we have no complaints. You have any complaints?
Mm-hmm.
I have none.
Well, what about your, how did you feel the first time you moved to, and you said you had migrated to Barbados
yeah.
and then to the U.S., I guess.
Yeah. Well, I was 18 years old and just finished school and loved my rock and roll.
Yeah.
And yeah. Wanted to learn as much as I could.
Mm-hmm.
So I got there with great expectations and everything fell into place. The only shock for me, the first night I was there, we lived right on the beach. The hotel was right on the beach. And,
where was this morning?
In Barbados.
Barbados.
Yeah. And that night I got into the hotel and a funny smell came up from the floor. It was the hotel was wood. The floor was wood. And let's see, what is this? It's a smell of rats.
Mm.
I don't know, maybe rats living underneath. And,
wow.
So my mind ran back to home and said, have mercy. I'm 1,100 miles from home. There's no car to drive to get back home, Martin. No way to get back home to get out of this. But in a few minutes, it dawned on me, you're here about becoming a man. So, snapped out of that, and next morning I got up and let everything fall into place. So, it was a great experience for me. Yeah.
What about going to the U.S.?
Well, the U.S., it was the greatest culture shock I had, because prior to going there, we'd see a lot of white tourists come to Jamaica. And most of the blacks that came to Jamaica were people in the services, the army and the marines and so on. And I built up this expectation that in America everything is clean and rosy and everything is in place, because we did American geography, but we never touched American history. And I could understand why it wasn't exposed to us. But 2 years before coming to America, I just read upon the killing of Martin Luther and the Kennedy brother who was killed in California, the Attorney General. But it didn't dawn on me that when I get to America, I would see the things that I saw. I never expected to see a white taxi driver. Because when the tourists come, they drop tips, $50 tips to $20 tips, $10 tips. A taxi driver wouldn't make that money. And I didn't expect to see a charred woman that was white. I didn't expect to see gray, dirty buildings. But the greatest shock was to see my people, my race, being in slavery to drugs. When I got to Harlem, there were these great lines of people, maybe from that building to this. And, you know, this was my first morning in Harlem. I asked my brother, what are these people, 10 o'clock in the morning? If they're lining up for work, aren't they late? Where are they going? When I got to understand that they're waiting for a hit of heroin, it was a great shock. I didn't expect to see my people living in one of the most prosperous countries in the world succumb to drugs to that level. So that was a great letdown. And pretty soon I got over that, and I got to understand that you can't solve all the problems of the world, but maybe if you make yourself someone that someone else could look up to, it might help them to shake some of these curses. So that was my cultural letdown.
Okay. How about Panama? Any expectations that were met or not met in Panama?
Not really. There's things that I heard of that existed before I got here, and I'm happy that I came after those were more or less done away with.
Things like what?
Well, I have no idea that prejudice was practiced here as it was in the U.S. See, in the U.S., we accept prejudice, not accept, but we more or less understand that prejudice was practiced on Negroes because it was easy, because Negroes were used as slaves. And if you teach or tell someone a lie often enough, sooner or later you will believe that that's the truth. So the damage that was done over 300 years is a damage that that's likely to pass from slavery to prejudice, and the people can live with it because they want to survive. But I had no idea that prejudice was practiced on people that were of a different complexion other than black. I didn't know that whites could use the practice of prejudice on someone who was so close in color to them. I thought it was easy to use it on a black man. But I understand prejudice was practiced here. You had black and white fountains, or the gold and silver fountains.
And in your country.
And you had two laws. The law practice are under the Louisiana system was used here. And you had the one law for the Panamanian. I had no idea that it was practiced. I think in my history, in school, it was touched on a little, but I had no idea that it was practiced here. That people, we touched a little bit on that.
Because
I remember when, I think 1958, when John D. Rockefeller could not go, I think it was either Panama or Venezuela. He had great holdings, but the people would not let him come to the country. And he had to divert and come to Jamaica for a vacation. So, we didn't touch it heavily in history, I have no idea that it was practiced here.
Okay. Yeah. What about your Mrs. Simons? Any things like this that you learned about Panama before coming, or not necessarily?
When we decided to move here, I was doing a little research on the internet, but I was only looking for like real estate and stuff like that, and different places, provinces. The weather was good, not too hot, not too hot, stuff like that. So I really didn't see that stuff until I got here and heard about it. The only thing I saw was like certain places in the city, tourists were not supposed to go, or strangers were not supposed to go because of crime. And the caution about cologne, things like that. But nothing that would stop me from coming.
There is from my experience and from my outlook and the way you deal with prejudice, slavery, the good you derive from the way you deal with it, and the detriments you derive from the way you deal with it, I must say that I admire the Panamanian people for their outlook and the way they should handle things. See, this country is one of the only countries that people are not really aggressively violent to foreigners or the practice of prejudice that they that was exercised on them, and they're so peaceful and gentle in the way they dealt with that, and for that reason they derive a benefit from it that other South American countries do not derive. The fact that the American dollar is used here or is a benefit to the country is because of the way you handled them when they were here. See, if take Jamaica for example, because of our practice and. We're going to take this back to Africa. Because of our practice to revolt against tyranny early and constantly, we have suffered as an island. Because when your opposition or opponent find out that you will not take stuff or settle for stuff quickly, he will leave you alone and he will withdraw support, and we talk about monetary support and other supports from you because you're too aggressive for his liking. You, if you can draw a picture, There's some things I don't want to say outright, but Jamaican currency can't be spent out of Jamaica. So Jamaica is dependent on foreign help for imports, even for survival. So this is as a result of people who would not take stuff. So when a guy understands that this is where you are, he say, okay, I better leave them alone because I can't pull the wool over their eye. So when he leave you alone, he leave you without the means of survival. But if you handle it a little different, like this country handled it, then you find they're able to survive with the support of the devil.
There you go.
Stop putting it lightly. Uh-huh. Yeah. 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 You can survive, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you. Did you find a community, meaning you've moved now to all these different places, right? London, U.S., Panama, Barbados, U.S., Panama. In each of those places, did you ever find a community that pretty much served the purpose of a network or so forth, help you settle in to your new homes in each of those times?
Not the community, the individual,
mm-hmm.
but the whole community, like some individuals. Mm-hmm. I can remember when we moved into our first home in England, that the neighbors and their wife, one's on the left, because we have a corner, one's on the left, they brought wood. It was no central heating or you have to catch fire, and each room had a fireplace. You had to burn wood or coal. And the one on the left brought us some wood. And the one on the back brought us some wood. So I don't know, they think these people must come from a hot climate. They need to be warm. And they did welcome us into the community. I have to step back and say that not all white people are the same, because these were white people that came and welcomed us, and we were the only black around that area at the time. So, you know, my hat is off to some of them, and that is an Indian. In America, in Florida, we met a lot of people that were very helpful, like when we moved there, and kind of helped me tell him. I met him when I moved there. And in America, in Ohio, same thing happened. We bought a home beside white on the right, and there was an apartment building on the left. And that lady came running over to welcome us to the community. If there is any help that we needed, just call on her. And we were able to get different services, the numbers from her to call and get things done. The one across the street, there was a black on the left and a white on the right. The white one came over and she welcomed us to the community. Guess who didn't welcome us? Huh? The black one. They never came over. But one Sunday, my husband was in the garden cleaning up, And the wife called to him. She was going to church. She called to him to tell him he should be in church, not in the garden. But if she had a conversation with us, she would know that we went to church the day before, because we go to church on Saturday. But she didn't care to meet us, so she didn't know anything about us. So that is the difference. Where you live, it doesn't necessarily have to be in a black neighborhood because you are black and black are your people. It doesn't go like that. We were welcomed by the whites and the blacks. And that's here. Now here, we live among all Spanish. Spanish, if you know what you call those. And they're very, very lovely. Very kind. Wherever we go, they open the doors to us. No problem.
How about you, Mr. McFarland? From Barbados, and U.S., and Rock Harry?
I think there are two principles that if we practice and exercise, we don't find problems. I was taught from a kid that you demand respect by giving it. So I've exercised that, and I very, very, very seldom run into any problems when I move to any new place. Then there's another principle which is biblical, and if you practice this also, you won't run into problems easily. You're asked to put your trust in your Maker, and your Maker give you some principles to live by, and he said, if you follow these principles, he will make your enemy to be at peace with you. So we practice these principles, and some are wherever you go, you treat people kindly, remembering that you're a foreigner in a strange land. And at one time, all were foreigners in strange lands. Wherever I go, I don't care who, whatever neighborhood I go into, the first thing I do is say hello to everyone I come across. And people can tell when your hello is genuine. They can tell. Don't deceive yourself. If your hello is just a face card, they can tell. And they'll shun you and put you aside quickly. But when your hello is genuine, they can sense it from the heart. And for this reason, I've had a problem wherever I've gone. I treat people with respect right up front. Oh, I don't mean from the poor to the rich to the downtrodden.
So no one particular community that welcomed you, and just everybody you've encountered, based on the way you treat people in general, has given you good positive experiences, I guess.
Yeah, there was an instance when I moved to Florida. I bought a piece of property from a real estate agent, and I didn't read all the fine prints on the contract. I didn't understand when I bought it that the land was not to be sold to blacks. The mineral rights were retained by the seller. I didn't know all that until when I signed the thing, the agent told me, you know, the mineral rights are mine. So it's an area where oil is found. So I thought about it for a minute. I was about to tell him, take the land back and give me my money. But I thought about it for a minute. I said, okay, I'm going to survive here. And you could always steal the oil from underneath the land without drilling a well on top of the piece you sold me. So let me just leave you alone. Time will take care of you. And it wasn't long before he got sick, or he gave up real estate. And yeah, he didn't have no children for all the proceeds to fall to. So I just left him to the will of God. But outside of I lived to see the area that wasn't supposed to be sold to blacks. More blacks, I think just about all blacks, with the exception of a few whites, all blacks bought into that. So God will take care of our problems, especially when you're black.
Are there, this is one example they're giving me. Are there any other particular moments, of interactions that you remember vividly and you'd like to share? I like the way you told me about the families who brought you wood in London. What about in the U.S. and Panama? Are there specific examples like that of interactions that you have with the people there?
Well, Panama is so sweet. We stayed in Edinburgh with some friends, and we were looking around. And it is amazing that we took a walk early one morning, because we were up 6:30. And we took a walk early one morning looking at, property and stuff like that. And we saw a place sale. So we're outside, beautiful place, sliding gates and so on. We're outside just looking. This is a sale, but maybe it's too early. So he told me, write the number down. So while I was searching in my purse, he had a piece of paper to write the door open. And the man came out. And he wanted to know if he was interested in the place. And he had to see it. Well, the guy touched a button and the gate's open. And we walked right in, and he took us from room to the yard, to everywhere. And that is really unusual. Because in the States, if you want to visit your friend, if you want to visit your church sister that you go to church with every week, you have to call and tell them when you would like to come, or make an appointment. So that, we couldn't understand. And that was not the only one. Several places we go to. But the one that really impressed me is where we are now in Kapira. A friend of ours wanted to buy some wood, some sticks to make her fence. So we went with her in her truck. You come go with us. So we got over to her, and she went in, and while she was negotiating with the guy to buy the wood, he had several mango trees, big, beautiful mangoes. And he went under the tree, and he was just looking at this one. He walked over to the other tree, and he's looking, and the guy came over. And he said, started to explain to him, this one sells for $3 each. He sells them to the hotel. And this one, the name of it. And then the man picked one off of each tree and gave us. That impressed me, because these are strange people. They don't even speak my language. And this is my prized fruit that I sell for $3 each. But I'm going to give them some. And that was really, really impressive to me. The kindness, love.
Wow.
Everywhere we go in Panama, everywhere we go. So one lady, I was telling her, she's born in Trinidad, but she lives in Canada, and she came to visit her mother. So I was telling her how I find the people there so loving and so kind. And she said to me, "Well, maybe it is your personality. Maybe because you are outgoing that they meet you that way." Because she is kind of, you know, not too, I'm not going to say too much. Like she can't raise her hand to, you know, she, that kind of, that kind of way. But that's what she's telling us, that because we are the way we are, because she's been coming to Panama around the same time that we've been coming. And she doesn't know anyone. She doesn't go anywhere.
Okay. Okay. That's funny. I experienced the same thing you experienced in the States.
Okay. Okay.
It's so weird. The first time I was told to never show up at a friend's house without calling, I was like, what?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's okay. This is the culture of difference.
Why different?
Yeah.
But he would not call. He would go. Yeah. And
then
he
show up.
You got to go.
There are some principles that when you practice these principles, they bring out a trait that tells people who you are. See, I've gone places and people treat me in your presence. Sometimes she's scared to ask or knock on the door, ask a question, and I tell her, "No, not me, I'm going." And she, "But you're not." I said, "No, I'm going." Someone can look at you and sense whether you're real, whether you're a shyster, whether you're a thief, whether you're a person I can trust, just like that. See, I believe when you practice good principles, and I'm speaking, whether it's biblical or from good home training, when you practice these principles and walk, wherever you walk, people can tell who you are. And I think that's a reason people can admit you into their house or take a chance with you, because these principles radiate in you. And they can tell, look, this is not just someone who's coming to my house to spy, to come back and rob later. These really pan out. And wherever you go, people can tell who you are, because they got that inner sense that tells them that these people are not phonies.
Some of these questions you may have answered before, so I'm going to ask them again just to make sure I covered everything. What made you decide to move to Panama again? You said you're retired now?
Yeah, we both retired.
Okay. And that was mainly when you visited?
I was retired before, and he was just getting ready to retire. And we were thinking of going back to Florida. But Florida becomes so expensive. And when we came here and seeing the fruits are flowing, fresh fruits, the food is good, the place to live is nice and quiet. Why would we go to Florida or go anywhere else? We said, in Florida you can get oranges and you can get mangoes. That's about it. Fresh. Fresh. You can't get pineapples. You know, we come here, pineapples are $3 for $1. You know, we could eat enough pineapples. My husband, he likes pineapples. I used to eat the slice, but can't get enough pineapples to eat. And he'd buy oranges by the vine, a big bag, $3 or $4. So when we see that, we're thinking, our social security can stretch more here than in the state. And we have a friend that is getting ready to retire at the end of this year. And for him, because he has a family, just have a daughter that graduated from college. He wanted to send her on to university now, right? He would have to work forever.
Mm-hmm.
And we have several other friends that. But they don't want to come here because they miss the children and they miss the grandchildren, and so they stay there and suffer.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any jobs to go to, so we
can always visit.
I always visit. And every time I talk to somebody, they say, "When are you coming?" I said, "We just left. almost three years, but we just left."
Wow. Wow. Well, what did you know about Panama before you came? I don't remember if you mentioned that before.
Well, I had several friends from Panama. I have a lot of co-workers from Panama, but the funny thing is that I just knew they were from Panama. But they never talked about Panama. They never invited me to Panama. And they never came back to Panama, not even on vacation.
Wow.
My daughter's godmother is Panamanian. She's one of my good friends and co-workers. But that's about all she knew about Panama. She born in Panama. Her husband born in Panama. Her children born in Panama. And she brought them all over to Panama. And never came back, not even on vacation.
Did she ever say why?
Never. I never asked because, you know, kind of private.
So then in that case, what brought you? In addition to just knowing these people who were from
just that one couple, the wife from the family.
Okay.
And she was coming back to visit her mom and invited us to come on vacation with her.
Wow.
That was it.
Wow.
And all our friends really thought we were crazy. And the next thing that puzzled my friends is, how can you build a house? You do not understand Spanish. The workers does not understand English. How are you managing? Very well, thank you.
Wow. How?
Yes. Good question. But one of the reasons is my husband, 1, 2, 3, he got quite a bit of Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
I am still struggling.
Mm-hmm.
But he knows enough to explain what he needs done. and get it done. And of course, my expression and gestures and things like that. And if you fall into holy call, someone that speaks Spanish and English. We have friends that speak both languages. And have been, but we never had to call anyone. Wow. We never had to. Make ourselves understood.
Mm-hmm.
Getting everything that we want done.
Right.
Even Panamanians here are afraid to build, and they speak the language.
Exactly.
You know, they keep saying, well, the guy's going to rob you blind, and they're going to do this, and once they might be stealing the cement right under your eyes, and you know, all kinds of things they would tell us. And one of our church brothers said, you know, even the ones in the church you can't trust.
Wow.
So they had a, in fear, but my husband and said, no, we're going to build because the rooms are too small and we, you know, we can't get our stuff in there.
Wow.
It's working out good.
Yeah.
We're living in there now about almost 2 years. We're living in there, but it's not complete. You know,
mm-hmm.
It would take.
Exactly. How would you characterize your experience here overall?
Good experience.
Yeah.
Very good experience.
You mentioned that.
No problem.
What are the favorite things about being here in Panama? You've mentioned some of the fruits and so forth. What else would you say?
Traveling around. Because in the United States, I have done some traveling. But it was limited because I was retired and my husband was still working. So it was just like a long weekend. And so we go to Canada or go somewhere and we have to be back in time to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
Here now, we can go somewhere, spend a few days, and don't have to worry about that. Sometimes we don't have anyone working, so we take the opportunity to see something. And definitely like that, like traveling.
You said you had visited which places?
We went to Darlene, we went to Bogus del Toro, we just got in the bus and went to Dabi,
mm-hmm.
and came back. We didn't stay there too long. And we went on the canal, and where are the other places? Since we're here.
Place of Bukin?
We're going to be
waiting
for the house. Asos de Maria.
Yeah. Well, Asos
de Maria, yes.
Chica.
Out there, yeah.
Penonome.
Yeah, Campana.
Campana, see. Up to the mountains.
El Valle.
No, not to El Valle. Not yet.
Okay.
Caimito. Yeah. And we've been to the ports like Punta Barco, Coronado,
Chame.
Punta
okay.
Chame.
Okay.
Yeah, the beaches.
Yeah. What do you not like about Panama?
Is there
anything at all?
What is there not to like about Panama?
Nothing.
Nothing not to like
about Panama. See, we're not allowed to speak on anything political.
No.
Yeah, I think the U.S. don't appreciate you speaking on anything political about the country you're residing in. What do you not like? Some things I don't like, but in each country, the people have a right to look and see what's not
working for them.
Yeah. try to do something peacefully about it. Yeah. Something I want to say. What were you talking about when we left?
What are our favorite things about being here? Yeah, how was the experience overall?
There was something specific you asked her before.
How you made move. You learned a little bit of Spanish and you've been getting...
Yeah, I wanted to speak on this because this is going to benefit the youngsters that will hear or see what we're talking about. There are some things in life that you should never neglect. One is the space that God is providing for you in life. And the next is the impulses you get. Never sit on an idea. Do something about it. Never neglect education. When I was in school, you were asked to take a foreign language. But we had to take two, because we had to take Latin, because if you're going to become a doctor, then everything with medical terms and all that, little Latin. And Spanish was something I tried to grasp my Spanish, not knowing that I would wind up in Panama in my retirement age. Then in the 70s, when things were slow in the U.S., I had an impulse to come to Panama. And I didn't follow up on it. I had two impulses. One, to go to Alaska because we were working on pipeline. I tried that, but I couldn't get in there because of the unions. And the next was to, why not go to Panama? Because the Americans are here. And you might be able to get a job in Panama. I didn't jump on that impulse, but now looking back on what I could have done from that time to now, if I had come to Panama, I would have made some headway. Yeah. So, in order, I'd say to, especially for children and youngsters, do not sit on ideas and do not neglect learning, especially a foreign language.
One observation that I would like to make is that the older kind of Indians of West Indian descent speak English, but their children and grandchildren will not speak English. Now it's coming to the point where you need speak English to get a proper job in Panama. So I was asking my friend, why your children not speaking English? His cousin, why your children not speaking English? No, they have to pay some college, some school, and what they are getting is not conversational English. They're getting grammatical English. They give them a test on paper, they can pass it. But talk to them in English, they cannot answer. And that is what I observe here. And that is a part of our culture. Your parents come from the island, and your parents speak English. You speak English, but when I ask the question, they say the children do not want to speak English. Now, when they come out of school, they want to speak English. Too late. Now you're going to have to pay, and you're not getting it right.
Mm-hmm. Big problem.
Big problem. And we were at Playa Blanca, and all the workers there are Spanish, and they all, down to the taxi driver, speak English. Why our children are not speaking English? Now the people that we came to stay at, the mother, speak all English in the house, so her children speak English. The grandchildren want to speak English. When they come to the house and she tried to teach them, they want to speak English. And these are little kids. Why? I don't understand why.
They don't understand that. For some reason in life, people are always called upon to migrate. Always. There is a time when people are called upon to migrate to France, Italy, England, US, other parts of South America, maybe. And when that time comes, you're required to speak English or a foreign language. So when it's offered to you, I shouldn't say offered, it should be the duty of those with African descent, meaning West Indians or whatever, to force their children to speak a language, because children are not going to learn what they don't want to learn, and they don't care to learn too much. You have to force them to learn those things that will become beneficial to them in life.
Yeah, we have a friend that her mother is an English teacher. She's retired now, but her mother was an English teacher. And she said her mom did not speak any English in the house. And her brother, he speaks very good English. And he works in the tourist trade, doing tours or stuff like that. And he said he paid to learn English, and his mom English teacher.
Wow.
But he probably did that as he became an adult, but maybe she tried to teach him when he was small and he didn't want it. he didn't tell me that, but I suspect, maybe, I don't know.
Wow. That's very common, unfortunately, here.
Yes,
very,
very,
very
common.
Very common
here.
Let's see. I'm going to go. Okay, how would you compare your experience as a person of primarily African descent here to your experience as a black person elsewhere, whether it's Barbados or the U.S.? How would you compare those experiences?
Cross country compared to Panama?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. You want to go first?
Me, I don't have any negative experiences, not even in England. When I went to England, and there were just a handful of blacks when I went there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any negative experiences.
It's pretty much the same in all different places.
Same. Even America, that's supposed to be. I don't know, maybe in the right place at the right time.
I found a vast difference in experiences in Barbados. That was good. Panama, good, excellent. In the U.S., I found that you have to force people to accept you. Really. You have to force, even it's gotten to the point where as a black person, you have to force a black American to really accept you. Because this 300 years of prejudice and slavery has brought him to the point where he don't trust even himself. Now, there's a good side to the Black American side of this. He will mind his own business and leave you alone. But if you need help looking to your culture, looking to your race for help, you're not going to find it easily amongst the blacks. Now, I don't know if you're aware of that. Organizations like the NAACP, their major support is from whites and Jews. You want to wear that? Yeah, dig into that. That's where their major support, when I say support, financial. Because our problem is how to get along, and we need finances to get along. And that's where our support comes from. If you look at the way black entertainers handle their money, I think around 1998, a survey was made. So we took in what? Something like 12 billion as blacks. The majority, I think, maybe what they say, something like 65% of all the TVs, entertainment equipment that was sold, we bought it. The shoes, the cars, the jewelry, we bought it. The furniture, we bought it. How much did we return to those people who bought our records and what kept us in the entertainment business? How much did we return to those people? How much did we give to the colleges, black institutes, so our people can live on a better standard? Not much. We gave it all back to the people who paid us.
You returned it back.
Yeah. So, culturally, we have a problem there. Here, so far, in Panama, the experience I've gathered here is sweeter than any other place I've been.
Yeah.
Even my native Jamaica.
Mm, wow.
Crime and just to be gullible and get to be envy that cause a person to want to see everything that you earn from migration is sucked out of you. That's a principle that's something I experience in my native country, New Ireland. In Panama, as long as you treat people nice, they got great respect for you. And I appreciate your country greatly for that. Yeah.
Well, you said a little bit of this before, but I'll ask you in case you want to add, in addition to what you said, what specific message do you want to communicate to the younger Panamanians about your cultural background? So, meaning the generation or generations behind you, about your specific backgrounds yourself.
Well, what I'd like the younger generation to learn if they didn't learn it, or to practice if they were asked to practice it or not, is to remember one biblical principle. Honor your mother and your father so that your days can be long And this is us by your God, who told you he would make your way prosperous and make your days long. Honor your mother and your father.
Sections. How do you define yourself in terms of cultural, racial, or ethnic identity?
What do I
define yourself?
Technical.
Yeah, this is very technical. Yeah, exactly. Ultra technical.
I define myself as a person who God has created with a purpose and he has given me the potentials and he's asked me to live this purpose out and the potential is in me. My job is to work the potential out because he has blessed me with the ability to do whatever I want to do if I aspire and work along with it. Mm-hmm. Knowing one thing, that only 8 people came off the ark. From those 8 come all these races. So I should never be fearful of any race or color or creed that will want or have a desire to suppress me. He will pick me up and set me where he want to if I just walk with him.
And what particular race would you put yourself into? What category of those races or cultures, what category would you put yourself
in? I put myself in the race that the Bible called the darker races that were settled in the land of Canaan.
I would say I belong to the human race because all of the races are human. And I would say, I could come back and say, a part of me, apart from being human, I'm black. Mm-hmm. And that's how God made me. I can't change it. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was in England, I was sitting on a bus beside a mom and her daughter. And I don't believe that little girl had ever seen a black person. So I was sitting in the bus moving, and she was in the mom's lap. And all of a sudden, I, you know, looked from the corner of my eye, and I saw the little hand come over.
Ooh, it's
and
so
she
cool.
Did like,
oh
and
God.
She did like that.
Oh boy.
And I turned to her and said, "Oh, honey, it doesn't come off." And the mother was so embarrassed. She turned red and she tried to pull the girl over, and shaking her and falling. I said, she's just curious. She may have never seen a black person. But God made us all. As my husband said, off of the ark, all these colors came up. And we all are human. So you deal with each person individually. You do not deal with a person, you shouldn't deal with a person because they are black or white or yellow or whatever color. Deal with them as an individual, as another human being. And if you do that, if everybody in the world did that, there would be no problems. He doesn't like me because I'm black. She doesn't like me because I'm Chinese. They don't like me because I'm Indian. And what all that is for? We are human beings. We all have the same type of blood running through. Eyes, nose, the same bodily function. We have the same exact thing. Mm-hmm. It's just pigment of the skin that is different. How would you like that everybody is my same shade? Or everybody is your same shade? Because even white has different shades of white. As blacks have different shades of blacks. And you put us all together with you. Yeah, my father.
Do you ever feel yourself to be between multiple identities or cultures?
Never.
cultures, yes.
Mm-hmm. Culture?
Yeah.
Which would those be?
Multiple
or cultures, yeah.
All right. Let's phrase the question again. Let me see if I got you.
Do you ever feel yourself to be between multiple identities or cultures? Multiple identities or multiple cultures?
I'd say cultures.
Mm-hmm. Like that.
Yeah. There are times when there are times when you find yourself liking things of another culture, foods or clothing or way of life, and you wonder why is this so? Yeah, you might find yourself liking something which is of Chinese culture, foods and clothing, and you ask yourself, why is it so? You find yourself liking something that's Arab or white, for white culture, and you ask yourself, why is it so? Then, when you understand a little more in detail, we understand that the black gene is able to produce any other mix. The black mixed with any other can produce, a Chinese can produce this or that. And he said, well, truly, God must have been right when he said only 8 people came off the ark. And from those 8 come all these races. So if they got different cultures and you figure yourself, I'm out of place with this feeling and this culture, then something must be in me that's accustomed to all of these cultures.
Right. I never feel in between of any of these. I guess I make myself at home wherever I am. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever foods I get, I eat it. I live in England, and I eat what they have there, Brussels sprouts and crumpets, and, you know, I like them. And I live in Jamaica, and I eat ackee and codfish and, you know, green planting and stuff like that. I go to America, I eat hot dogs and hamburgers. I come to Panama, I eat empanadas and patacones. So I blend into wherever I live. So I have no difficulty in anything to eat, no difficulty in anything to wear, no difficulty at all.
Tell me about your view of your West Indian ancestry and how important or relevant is it to you? Your ancestry being from Barbados.
Yeah. Well, it's important because you like to know where you're coming from. Apart from that, you have to come from somewhere. So it shouldn't be a big deal. I would like to know more about my ancestors, especially the ones from Sierra Leone, because that's the only one that I know way about. The others, I do not know where exactly they originated from. So the one that I know about, I would not mind knowing anything about it, but I'm not knocking myself up to find out. You know what I mean? I'm not going to take a trip there. I wouldn't even know how
culture started. I have no names or anything. So I don't think it's that important. You're alive, and you know you come from somewhere. You know your parents, you know your grandparents, and you go on from there. One thing that our parents didn't do, I don't know about him, but my parents did not follow history. I have my grandmother has a sister that was married to a Jamaican and went to live in Jamaica. She had children there, but you never get in touch. I could be married to a relative. I don't know. You know what I mean? But it's not really important because I don't know. So I just take life as it is. I don't make my head grow too big with too much stuff.
I think cultures are very, very, very good importance. In my culture, on the black side, we came out of Ghana, and I think the reason they shipped, especially the Maroons out from Ghana, was because the Maroons didn't take anything. Don't give me no stuff. They didn't take it from there. And what they did in Africa, when they caught those who were revolting against the system, they arrested them and they sold them as slaves to get rid of them, because they're like an annoyance to troublemakers.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not troublemakers just to be troublemakers. They're troublemakers because there were people who were abusive to a system that was good. And this is the reason they caught them and shipped them out. But they served their purpose when they came to the New World, because they would not take the stuff that slavery was issuing out, and they fought against it, and that's the reason we got emancipation so early in Jamaica, 1838, as opposed to 1865 in the U.S. and early in Haiti. So these are people who did not take stuff. And in this world, you shouldn't take some of the stuff that's dished out to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's on the black side. On the white side, when you read the traits and the history of the people from Scotland, they were noted as a people with dignity, and a people who were considered trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are two cultures that I'm descendant from, and I really admire those cultures.
How did you, you're married, correct? How did you meet each other? And where?
Because men don't remember these things.
Yeah. We met at a party and I don't want to say where I studied this, but there are a lot of things that you learn from people just by a handshake. They say when you touch someone, there are a lot of things that you learn about the person you touch, whether it's just a casual handshake or whatever. So I'd say that's how I got attached to her.
I said a touch. I said I did say a touch, whether it be a handshake or yeah. So that's how I got attached to her.
And you said at a party?
Yeah.
In Barbados?
No,
Florida.
In Florida.
Oh, in Florida. Okay.
We did not know each other in Barbados. We knew each other in Barbados. Already.
Mm-hmm. You're left. Okay. So, correct, right?
Yeah.
You got it right.
We had it a party.
And do you have any children? If so, how old are they now?
Oh, my goodness. I have 4 children. Now the ages. We start from the bottom of the world. Jenny, my daughter, is 38. Mm-hmm. And one son is 43. Mm-hmm. And another is 48.
Female or male?
Huh?
A daughter or son? 48. Son, son, son.
Okay. I just have one girl. Oh, okay.
She was the first one I thought.
Oh, okay. And the other one's 50. Okay. All right. Where were they born? Two were born in Barbados. The oldest, Bella? Two. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. One died. Another one. One of those was born in Barbados. The first one died. So I didn't put him down. So one of those was born in Barbados, one born in England,
mm-hmm.
one born in Jamaica, and one born in the U.S.
Jamaica, U.S. Oh, so the youngest was born in the U.S.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about what they do, what are their lives like, what do they work, what do they do here?
Yeah. Start from the bottom again.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter is a police officer. One son is a mechanic. One son is a doctor. And one son is a bomb.
Which is the bomb?
Which is the
girl?
The second one.
The second 43-year-old? Okay.
The second one.
Okay, okay. Oh, the one's 48.
Yeah.
Okay, okay. And the doctor is 50?
No, I have it all wrong. Sorry, I keep saying the second one because I had 5.
Okay, okay.
That would be the first, the one
that is 50. Uh-huh. Okay, yeah. So that's 48.
Yeah.
43. Okay. Do they consider themselves West Indian or something else? I don't know, American? Or
my daughter considers herself American.
She is American.
She is born and raised in America. My children, the boys, consider themselves West Indian.
Okay. How, what specific message, I think you actually answered this already, what specific message would you communicate to Panamanians about your cultural background? I think you kind of answered that.
Yeah.
Let me answer. What would you like Panamanian youth to know about your culture and the culture of your place of birth? Again, this is similar to something you asked before with Barbados and Jamaica and so forth. If there's anything else you'd like to add or include at all?
The only thing is that I would like them to do, especially the ones with the English background, is to study the English.
Mm-hmm.
That's a part of their culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even though I do not know African.
right. There you go. That's
but
what
I
would say.
I don't need to speak African to get a job.
There you go.
But now, most of the jobs require, because Panama right now is trying to entrance people coming to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And English seems to be the first language right now.
Yeah.
So the work anywhere that is in front of the public, where you have to deal with people coming in to Panama that speak English, you need
We
met a guy at a gas station, and he got the job there because he spoke
English.
Pumping gas.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that is how he got his job, because he could speak English.
That's right.
So it is important.
That's exactly it. And I don't know how to get it through so many
people. we bought some mangoes at the side of the street, and it was an Indian lady. And we trying to speak Spanish to her. She said, speak to me in English.
There you go.
Speak to me in English. Yeah. So, and she is trying to learn English. Why the ones that can go to the parents, daddy, grandparents, if they're going wrong and people correct me, mom, is this what you say, how you say this in English? Do it. You don't have any children?
No, not yet. Believe me, if I do, they will speak English. At least English and Spanish.
They need both.
Yeah. Well, now all that's left are demographic questions, which is...
To the cultural thing. Yeah. The benefits we derive from our culture are great because we paid attention to what our parents were teaching us. They taught us to be prepared for all kinds of experiences in life. And the greatest preparation you can make is to get a good education or get a skill, because down the road in life, you are going to be called upon to support a family, and to have a roof over your head. So, as you go along life and you start working, if you make a dollar, save 10 cents. They always use the little saying, try and get the bird nest before you bring the bird in. True in life. Try and get yourself a profession, because especially if you're a woman, they always tell you that, because the man, you might be the unfortunate woman who go there and father and mother children, and the father take off. You got no profession, no skill to fall back on. Find yourself a skill. The next thing they tell us, bear your yoke in your youth. Try your best to bear your yoke in your youth. When you grow up and get old, not many things you can do, and you might get kicked to the side of a curb. So walk straight as a woman. As a man, be honest. Respect women the same, with the same respect you give your mother. And the Bible asks us to honor your mother and your father. So these are some of the cultural principles that we were brought up in. And these are some of the reasons why you find the more productive citizens in this age, 2008, are those who came out of the culture of the 40s, 50s, 60s. The cultures after that were very lax.
Yeah.
And now we're looking at children who cannot, grown men and women who are still living at home, cannot provide for themselves, cannot cope with the demands of the world, only because the principles that were handed down
are not being handed down today, those cultural principles. So we need to fall back on those principles.
Those children were my children. He's God. He's one. But you need like three papers.
Okay. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, 8 children.
Okay.
5 boys, 3 girls.
5 boys, 3 girls.
2 girls in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
One is always learning something new. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Always learning something new. She's a provider for her children and herself. Always learning something new in order to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is just wayward. Then, what is it? 5 girls?
Five boys and 3 girls?
5 girls and 3 boys.
She got it back.
I got it back.
5 girls, yeah. 3 boys. Yeah.
3 years
in the States. Yeah. Mm. And the 3 girls are in the U.S. and one is in Canada, you said?
Two in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
1 boy in Jamaica and the other in the U.S. The other two in the U.S. Two were born American citizens.
Mm-hmm. And one in Jamaica.
And the other 6 children are born in Jamaica.
So there's 3 girls in the U.S., 2 girls in Canada, 2 boys in the U.S., 1 boy in Jamaica,
yeah.
And then there are 6 girls in Jamaica.
No, there are six children that were born in Jamaica.
All the girls were born in Jamaica.
No, 1 girl was born in the U.S. and 1 boy.
Ah, so, what do you told me one of your girls is a provider. What do the boys do?
When I say a provider, she's always learning.
Finish up her new prose.
Yeah, always learning. She's a chef.
Mm-hmm.
She was in the nursing field.
Of course.
Yeah. Always learning another skill because.
Yeah.
Who was it that said, the man who speaks 2 languages is worth 2 men? Yeah. So I admire her for that. Always learning something new. If she get out of a job, you lay her off here, she's gone something else.
Yep.
Yeah.
Isn't the girl who's in the U.S.?
No, in Canada.
In Canada, right.
Yeah.
What are the boys doing here in the U.S. and in Jamaica?
1 boy is like a clown, a black sheep, or whatever.
Like mine, a bomb.
Yeah.
Okay. One in every family.
The amazing thing about this one is hands are full with skills.
Very cool.
I mean, anything you take him at, he can do it. How we acquire these skills, I guess, is through the traits of the genes.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, he don't like to work for anybody. He's got to be working for himself.
Mm-hmm.
There are not too many people who pay you for working
for himself.
Yeah. So he's a bum in us. in certain regards. He would not, he doesn't want to settle down with a job.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah.
Skills, full of skills.
Yeah.
The bright ones are always
Exactly.
Bright, but they use it the wrong way.
You know, it takes a little extra to really dedicate to working on things. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. I think I have it. Okay. Years of birth. This is not just demographic. Your year of birth, Olivia?
1935.
Okay. And sir?
42. 1942.
Okay. And what is the last level of school completed by both of you?
what secondary school? I don't know what grade.
I was a little different. Our secondary is equivalent to, well, to be honest, I went to Clarendon College, and I went to take a chemistry test in Florida for water treatment, and I passed my test, and they tell me they were surprised because college grads or university grads came through there that could not pass a chemistry test, and we're talking 30 years after I left school I didn't use chemistry. So it's hard to say what level our level is. Way higher than me.
Level. I've heard that before too. A lot of the folks here who came from secondary back home was more equivalent to the first few years of college. What are your professions?
Oh my. What did I do? I did a lot of things. But,
what did you retire from?
I retired from, I'm an EMT. That was the last thing I did.
Okay. Anything else you want to add?
Mentioned before, beautician, a dressmaker, jack of all trades.
Okay. I'm Mr. Mubani.
Oh boy. My first job was a telegraph operator. Then after that, went back to trade school and I became a millwright.
A millwright?
Millwright.
What's a millwright?
Millwright would be jack of a few trades, sheet metal worker, machine shop operator, welding, sheet metal working, and a plant. Then a plant operator, which would be like Alcan, aluminum company.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Then what I did after that? Water treatment, wastewater treatment, pipe fitting, pipe fitter,
jack of all trades,
plumber, carpentry, electrician, auto mechanic. Yeah, that's the last thing I did. The last 13 years, auto mechanics.
Okay, auto mechanics.
Yeah.
And okay, what do you want now in your cafe then? Do you know the name of your specific neighborhood in Capira?
Sierra Lita.
C-I-R-U-E-L-I-T-T-O.
Okay, Sierra Lita. I see.
Like
Venezuela. You didn't want to age of children.
No,
it's
too many.
Believe it or not, that's true, but we actually got to the end of the questionnaire. And just want to thank you again for participating. This is really great information you've shared with us. And as you know, we're using this for educational purposes. To share with the community, but really mainly to educate folks about the different things that our people are doing all over the world, in addition to here in Panama. And in the case of the focus of yours, it has to do a lot with folks traveling, moving around, and the obvious connections with your stories and the stories of the people I'm interviewing is also very beautiful, because you're talking about things that some of the older folks are mentioning in our interviews because they remember from their parents telling them back home versus, you know, so that's been very good for me too, so thank you.
You know, we did two surveys in 1968. We did a survey from a world survey on youngsters, on people. And in the survey they said the Jamaicans were the most eager to learn. Then in 68 America did a survey on blacks. See, blacks in 68 blacks had started breaking out, because during the movement of the Black Power and who else was in there during the time of Marion McKeever and that time, blacks were breaking out of the stranglehold of racism.
Right.
And they had gotten to the point where they were going back to colleges. You know, people like Thurgood Marshall could not go to a college for his law degree, a college that they would recognize. They broke out and they were getting now into politics.
Yeah.
And they came up with a survey, how do we stop them? You know, it was done through Edgar Hoover, FBI chief. He wanted to stop these people before they get up there and get in power and start controlling things.
Yeah.
You know what they came up with? The ways to stop them? Drugs and the Inti. They said Inti, a Cadillac, shoes, a Cadillac,
right.
Fancy shoes,
right.
And drugs. And that's when they pump all that stuff into the colleges. Influential drug black movements. Did a number on us.
Exactly. I've read a little bit about the drugs.
Yeah.
And that really is just sickening. It's really sad how they just put it in places and then it just.
What is happening here now?
So these children need to wake up. Say, how many of them are going to school now? Kids picking up education. So much that you don't have enough jobs for them. So they don't understand when this happened. And the other nations, you see, Italy not producing children. Italy needs workers. Panamanians are required, are needed in Italy. But you must speak their language. Don't neglect the foreign language. But sooner or later, they're going to say, oh, you're progressing too fast. How can we control you?
There you go.
Be aware of the inventions of the so-called. Because you don't want to see you get to the
that
point
good.
Where you can control nothing.
Not that good. Exactly.
But you must be very alert. Very alert. And that's where our cultures come back in. The things that your parents taught you. Try to remember them.
Stick to you.
Very true. We're done. Wow. Yeah.